What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Coming up, dissent in modern Russia. We'll be hearing from journalist and activist Zharna Nemtsova and leading academic on authoritarianism Ben Noble about why free speech in the country can come at the very highest of costs. Our host for today's discussion is Polina Ivanova, correspondent for the Financial Times covering Russia and Ukraine. Here's Polina with more.
Boris Nemtsov was one of Russia's most eminent politicians in the 1990s. He offered hope for a prosperous, democratic future for Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union. As deputy prime minister under Boris Yeltsin, some believed Nemtsov would one day become president. But in 1999, Yeltsin appointed Vladimir Putin as his successor. Putin has now been in power for over 20 years. Nemtsov dedicated his life to fighting against corruption in the Putin-led system, a career which ended his life. In February 2015, he was fatally shot as he walked across a bridge in central Moscow, a stone's throw from the Kremlin. The Kremlin has repeatedly denied any involvement in Nemtsov's murder. 7 years later, in March 2022, an investigation by Bellingcat, The Insider, and the BBC found that Nemtsov was being tailed for the last year of his life by an FSB agent. The same agent has also been implicated by journalists in the attempted poisoning of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny on a plane in Siberia in August 2020. Navalny, who, like Nemtsov, also dedicates his life to fighting corruption in Russia, spent months recovering, and when he returned to Russia in January 2021, he was arrested immediately in Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport. He remains in jail today. So what does it mean to take on the Kremlin, to oppose Putin? And is it still possible at all, after Putin sent his troops into Ukraine and launched the toughest domestic crackdown on his critics yet? I'm joined by Zharna Nemtsova, journalist, activist, daughter of Boris Nemtsov and founder of Boris Nemtsov Foundation for Freedom, and Ben Noble, Associate Professor of Russian Politics at UCL and co-author of Navalny. Welcome to the podcast, Zharna and Ben.
Thank you, Polina, for having us today.
Since Putin launched his invasion of Ukraine in late February, things inside Russia have taken a very dark turn. If the space for free speech and independent journalism, for protest and activism had already been gradually shrinking since the start of Putin's rule, it seems it has now almost disappeared. I thought, Ben, maybe I could start by asking you to compare how the picture has changed in Russia, even from a few months ago.
I think it's difficult to exaggerate the degree to which the space available for opposition in Russia has shrunk. You rightly pointed out that that space has been shrinking over the last few years, and especially since Navalny returned to Russia at the beginning of 2021. We've just seen an extraordinary acceleration of that shrinkage since Russia invaded Ukraine on the 24th of February this year. So as well as looking at the political opposition, I think we can also think more broadly about critical voices in Russia, whether they be independent journalists or opposition politicians. And so it's difficult to escape the conclusion that the situation is very, very bleak. And people on the ground are either remaining quiet in order not to face the consequences of saying these critical things, or they've left the country, or they've already ended up in the law enforcement system in Russia, as we've seen with some notable opposition figures, including Vladimir Karamurza. It's a bleak picture and one that isn't likely to improve in the near future.
When the war broke out first, a lot of my opposition-minded friends in Russia or people that contacted in Russia who share a kind of liberal political view were sharing videos of Boris Nemtsov, actually. His speech in 2014, soon after the annexation of Crimea, was all over my Facebook feeds for a while, where Nemtsov was saying that this is an act that is shameful, is brazen, and speaking in front of a crowd of tens of thousands of people about Russia and Ukraine without Putin. I mean, anti-war slogans, mass protests, powerful speeches by important opposition leaders. I mean, Zharna, can you imagine a situation like that today in this moment?
The short answer to your question is no. To elaborate on what you've just said, I should admit my father was among few ones who was against the annexation of Crimea, even among liberally minded politicians. So it was very high on his agenda. And you've been talking about this massive protest in Russia, in Moscow. It happened in March 2014. It attracted more than 50,000 people, and they protested against the annexation of Crimea and the subsequent war in East Ukraine. So my father was a political visionary, and he understood earlier that Putin means war and crisis. And of course, I'm not surprised that his videos are going viral right now. He's regarded in Russia and beyond Russia as a political prophet who read Putin very early and understood where he was leading our country. For now, I think it's not appropriate to speak about Russian opposition as it doesn't exist. Opposition exists in a different environment, in a democratic society, in a country with a democratic system. We do not have any democratic system, any legal political competition. We should speak about dissenting voices. So there are a lot of dissenting voices in Russia, those who reach out to really big audiences, and among them are different people, politicians, activists, journalists. So lots of them fled Russia. Some of them still stay in Russia, but lots of them fled Russia, and lots of them are at a loss as what to do next. So the situation is very, very bad. And I think the major concern is about the state of the Russian society.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the exodus is a very important thing to think about, both in terms of Russian society, but also in terms of the impact on dissenting voices who have left for fear of the risks that they face. What happens to Russia with that voting bloc gone, with those voices out of the country? I mean, Ben, do you think that has a big impact on domestic politics? Can we see that that is another big shift?
Well, carrying on the point that Jana made, it's difficult to even talk about politics in Russia right now, insofar as politics is about debate, it's about conflict, it's about compromise. We're in a system now in the country where it's, I think the word totalitarian makes sense to apply to the political system. And that means precisely the exclusion of different voices, of dissenting voices. And so the fact that lots of these figures have left the country means that we have a very sterile environment in the country, a political environment, because it's the Kremlin. It's the Kremlin's desire to completely get rid of those voices. And I think we can see now, for those individuals who haven't, for example, been detained, arrested, put in prison, that the Kremlin wants those remaining individuals to leave the country. And that seems to be a clear preference. If these individuals are out of the country, then they're not going to get in the way of the Kremlin, for example, when it comes to elections, when it comes to trying to mount protests. That's one of the worrying developments, that these individuals leaving the country, they're leaving because things are very difficult for them. They, of course, don't want to live in an oppressive totalitarian society. But on the other hand, it means that the Kremlin is winning in that regard. But they really, in the long term, won't win, because a society that's based on fear and coercion and excluding voices isn't going to flourish. We're not going to have a society that is going to be stable in the long term. And I think that is consistent with comparative social science research on those types of political regimes that increasingly rely on coercion. It might give them short-term control, but in the long term, it opens them up to lots and lots of threats to their continued survival. The Kremlin claims that there is an opposition. And as political scientists, as academics, we often refer to the opposition in Russia with two terms, the systemic opposition and the non-systemic opposition. The non-systemic opposition consists of those groups that challenge the political system, that aren't on board with the Kremlin, that try and raise their voices to change the society. Whereas the systemic opposition, they're co-opted by the Kremlin. They include parties like the Communist Party that are really willing to support the Kremlin to do things. And occasionally they can say things that are quote unquote opposition critical. And going forward, what's interesting is that within the Communist Party, there are a few voices that are flirting with the boundary between the systemic and the non-systemic, including in the region, some younger people who are wanting to push back against this idea that the Communist Party is being co-opted by the Kremlin. And so I think if we are going to use the terms of opposition and we're thinking about the space left for opposition, we're in this maybe weird situation where we're looking within the Communist Party to these voices challenging the leadership. But we shouldn't get, of course, too carried away. These are individuals who are within the systemic opposition, who are then a party that's co-opted by the Kremlin. And it's tricky to, you know, talk about them in the same voice as the people who've demonstrated extraordinary bravery by saying much more forthright things, challenging the Kremlin in a much more direct way. That being said, I think if we are looking for politics and opposition within Russia, even if it's small, going forward, we need to look at the Communist Party. And we know that the Kremlin is also looking at the Communist Party. And it's why we've seen steps taken against some of those more radical voices within that party.
May I interrupt you, Ben? I have to object to one of your remarks. This term, non-systemic opposition, was coined by the Kremlin to marginalize those groups who were not under control of the Kremlin. So do not confuse people. Opposition is opposition. It doesn't matter whether it's systemic or non-systemic. People just don't understand those things. And yes, it's a Kremlin narrative. And also, I think that, you're talking about the Communist Party. I think that Russia actually needs a totally different kind of leadership right now, because we are facing very, very profound problems that many people haven't yet acknowledged.
There's also, if we're talking about types of opposition, there's now also an opposition in exile. So we now have these hubs in Tbilisi, in Georgia, in the Baltics, of people affiliated, for example, with the Navalny movement, Navalny himself being still in jail. Ben, you've written the book to read on Navalny and his movement. Do you think that it is lying in wait for another political moment? Do you think it has run its course? What is the state of that movement at the moment, it being the one which was in recent years best able to mobilize people to engage in, as you were saying, real politics in Russia?
When Navalny returned to Russia last year, the Kremlin, I think, very quickly showed the lengths that they're willing to go to in order to destroy his team and his movement, which is why we've seen people like Leonid Volkov lead the office in Vilnius to try and carry on the movement from abroad. But they realized that that isn't ideal. They have spoken previously about the fact that it's a Russian movement meant to be operating in Russia. And so this is very much not the location of their choosing. It's one of the reasons why Navalny returned to Russia at the beginning of 2021. He didn't want to be a Russian politician outside of Russia. He said in order to be effective, in order to lead the movement properly, he had to be in the country. Of course, given the extraordinary crackdown against Team Navalny, against the movement more broadly, they've had to leave. And in fact, Navalny has said to members of the team, to activists and supporters, I do not judge you if you leave the country. There's no point in your being locked up with me. Leave the country, carry on the activities, and then we can take stock from there. But of course, being outside of the country, as well as the various steps being taken by the authorities in Russia to limit the ability of their message to reach Russians in the country, there are clear limits to the extent to which they can shape the narrative. You know, Navalny became Navalny partially because of his extraordinarily successful YouTube videos. And yes, the Team Navalny from Vilnius are continuing to put together the anti-corruption investigations, to put out the videos, but they're constrained in really how influential they can be from outside the country. And only time will tell whether they will be able to continue to carry on that mission of pointing out elite corruption, whether that message can continue to inspire people, or whether they might have to change track. Only time will tell. I get the sense that they're still reeling from this extraordinary crackdown against them and against the dissenting voices more broadly in Russia last year and accelerated at the beginning of this year.
Well, at this point, it doesn't matter whether you are inside Russia or outside Russia. Since the invasion of Ukraine, the situation has changed dramatically. If you choose to stay in Russia, chances are very high you'll be jailed if you dare to voice any anti-governmental narratives. So it actually doesn't matter. You are in Russia, you are outside Russia. And if before some so-called democratic procedures were staged so the government and Putin pretended that Russia was a democracy. Now there is no any need for them to further pretend that Russia is a flawed democracy. They openly say that they are totalitarian, a quasi-totalitarian state. So why should it be important where you are right now?
I certainly wasn't trying to suggest that they could be doing what they were doing previously since the invasion of Ukraine. What the main point that I was making was that this space, small as it was, remaining at the beginning of last year in 2021, that's completely disappeared. And so they've had to leave the country, but that puts them in a weird situation, precisely for what Jana has said. From outside the country, they're going to continue doing the investigations into elite corruption. They're going to continue to put the videos on YouTube. But because of the steps that have been taken by the authorities to try and cleanse the information environment in Russia, to stop those dissenting voices being able to speak, they're limited in what they can do.
With a large proportion of anyone who had ever been involved in politics having to leave, or people who were independent journalists or in formal opposition groups or movements, many of whom have been forced to leave. And so those who are acting as dissenting voices at the moment, I'm finding them in, for example, the church or in the militarized police force and people who are refusing to go and fight, for example, or, you know, in these very unusual spaces. The space has shrunk, but it's also shifted. And I wonder whether you've come across any cases like that, and where is the dissent happening now?
Well, I don't think that there is a tendency. But it happened in the past, for example, when they were, and Ben, I think, knows about it pretty well, as he wrote a book about Navalny, co-authored a book about Navalny. So when they were pro-Navalny rallies in Russia, there were some dissenting voices coming from unusual places. It's very natural, but it's not something that can profoundly undermine the system. So we do not have to overestimate and to be overly optimistic about those single cases. But yes, as you do, I read the news and I know about some teachers in Russian regions and about those other people. And also from this piece written by Shura Butrin, so one of the findings is that people in Russian regions tend to be more critical towards the central government than people in Moscow. There are a number of reasons for that. First of all, I think that the impact of sanctions for them are harder. And second, if you look at those people who are fighting in Ukraine, I mean Russian soldiers, those are guys from very poor families from Russian regions. So Moscow is not affected, let me put it this way. So, and in those small places, people can feel the dreadful consequences of this senseless war in Ukraine. And that's probably they might be more critical. Of course, I'm not saying that that is the truth, but it might be the case. Because they face the reality, they have no choice, their sons are dying in Ukraine.
When thinking about these dissident voices that remain in Russia, one point I think worth stressing is that the new boundaries about what's acceptable and what is counted as being dissident or oppositional or stepping outside of what the Kremlin wants, that is in flux still because things have changed so quickly. Yes, it's an intensification of an existing trend, but I think people are still working out what is acceptable to do. What are the acceptable boundaries of how much you can get away with saying in relation to the war, in relation to the political system, in relation to the cause of economic problems? And we've seen people find different points to hit, and I imagine that will change going forward. And it could be that as the as Russia's war in Ukraine continues and as it sort of becomes more part of the broader landscape, that people find those lines and will settle down and challenge them in different ways. But I would point to, you know, two concrete examples, and it's looking at the Saratov regional legislature. And I'm going to talk about the Communist Party again. Unfortunately, I'm not looking at them because I think they're the bravest. Definitely not. But I think it's an interesting thing to follow. Two people, Nikolai Bondarenko and Alexander Anidalov, are within the Communist Party. And I think they're victims of the fact that the Kremlin now, they've got rid of the Navalny movement. And so now they're turning to those voices within the system who are, in a sense, going off script. And this is, of course, all in the context of the fact that in September this year, there are going to be local and regional elections. And the Kremlin wants to, I would say, nip in the bud this slightly more off script portion of the Communist Party, because the Kremlin now, as we mentioned earlier, has just had enough of imitating democracy. They're saying, okay, well, we had maybe this decorative opposition because it would allow us to say to the international community, look, we have a multi-party system. We've got the Communist Party. We have the LDPR, Just Russia. But now you really get the sense that within the presidential administration, those people who tried to, quote unquote, manage democracy, they're much less influential than the Siloviki, who are saying, well, stuff it. Why don't we just rule by force? Why do we have to imitate something? And so Bondarenko has already been kicked out of the regional legislature, ostensibly for not declaring money that he made from his quite popular YouTube channel. And then Anidalov tried to intervene when in Saratov, they changed the name of one of the central streets from Kirov Avenue to Stolypin Avenue. He tried to intervene and he was taken to a police department. It looks as though United Russia are trying to change the rules so that they can also kick him out of the legislature. The fact that those people are taking steps, they are putting themselves in the firing line. And that is one instance of people who are maybe dissenting.
Ben, may I disagree with you?
Please do.
You're talking about things happening on a micro level. I do not think that if Russia is led by any member of the Communist Party, we will succeed. The idea is that Russia should undergo really deep reforms. It needs another kind of leadership, another mindset, something very different. Because otherwise, it will be more or less the same. A country lagging behind the whole world, posing an existential threat to its neighbors, etc., etc. So Russia needs democratization and it needs another leadership. That's what I'm talking about. And all those minor things, I think they are not really important right now and they do not suggest anything about the future of our country. So it's a matter of luck, only a matter of luck. If I think that we are now witnessing like more or less the final years of Putin, the final years of Putin. So this regime might last for another 5 years, I don't know. But this is the final part of his rule. And I'm not thinking about what's happening now with those different people, but I'm thinking, does Russia have any future at all? The problem is that when a transformation happened in Russia and everybody was happy in the West, it was not a real transformation. My father was a unique example of a pro-democratic leader in our country. In many other regions who held the senior positions, who were governors and mayors, those people who previously had belonged to the Soviet elite. Who was Yeltsin? He was a real Democrat. I'm not sure.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. No Bullshit Leadership, brought to you by Intelligence Squared in partnership with Havas Creative, is back for a new season. In this straight-talking podcast, Chris Hurst, global CEO of Havas Creative, is joined each week by a leader from the world of business, sport, politics, or culture. We've got some fantastic guests coming up, including the editor of the Financial Times, Rula Khalaf, and entrepreneur, Sharmadeen Reed. Search No Bullshit Leadership wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to make sure you never miss an episode.
There's always this conversation within Russian liberal circles. There was always this conversation about compromise and the degree to which you compromise in order to be able to continue to act. Jeanne, more than anyone else, you've experienced your family has experienced the dangers and the risks of taking a fully uncompromising stance to opposing the Kremlin. Can we talk a little bit about the risks that you faced and the decision that you made to leave in 2015 that many people are now making this year?
Well, I should speak in strong terms. I despise those policy of compromises. And I have never compromised with the Kremlin. I have never tried even to find any compromises. Since my father's assassination, I made it absolutely clear I will pursue a fair and transparent investigation. And I do not care what Putin or the Kremlin think about my actions or anyone else. So I was regarded as a radical, but I didn't want to compromise. And so I decided to leave for two reasons, one of which was that I could not continue my professional career in Russia. It was absolutely obvious for me that I would sooner or later lose my job. I was a stock market commentator and I worked for RBC, which was a privately owned business channel. It was owned by Mikhail Prokhorov, one of the richest men in Russia. But soon after I left, television network changed hands. And now it belongs to a person very loyal to the Kremlin. Anyway, so another, of course, thing is my security. I do not want to put my life in danger. It was not secure to be there. And I got some threats via social media. And unlike many other people, I took them really seriously. And these were two reasons for me to leave. And I do not regret this decision.
I mean, we were talking before about whether or not some opposition movements being kind of permitted or cracked down upon, but not to the same degree as we're seeing now. Previously, was a kind of pressure valve that allowed people to express discontent with the system. Now that that does not.
But Polina, let's look at the outcome right now of all those efforts. It's a total disaster.
Well, so my question would be that, you know, do you think, Ben, that poses a risk of fracture in some way? I mean, for example, if the economic shocks of the sanctions continue, if they escalate, if people start feeling that pressure on their wallets, on their families, will that, in your view, destabilize the system in some way?
It's difficult to escape the possibility that if economic conditions in Russia continue to get worse, that Russians will be looking for somebody to blame. At the moment, given the way that the media environment is constructed and dominated by the authorities, currently the Kremlin is asking Russians, telling Russians to blame the West. They said, okay, there's the special operation taking place in Ukraine, but the real reason why the West is imposing sanctions that are leading to these economic problems is because they've been itching to do it for years. They've been looking for any excuse to impose sanctions in order to cripple the country, in order for the political system to change. And it seems to be, although it's very tricky, there are loads of caveats that we have to add about looking into what most Russians actually think at the moment, but it seems to be at the moment that that media framing is working, at least for a substantial portion of the Russian population. Going forward, though, the Kremlin runs a really serious risk, because what happens when economic conditions get dire, get catastrophic, when hundreds of thousands, millions of people lose their jobs, they don't have enough food to eat? How confident can the Kremlin be that their line of, oh, it's the West, blame the West, will continue? Because looking at comparative social science research, we do see moments where the people turn against the leadership, maybe after an initial rally round the flag effect, where people feel it's their patriotic duty to support the leadership, regardless of the nature of a conflict or whatever's taking place. And the worrying thing is that it seems that the Kremlin is aware of that. And it's one of the reasons why they've suggested that Moscow is giving more authorities to regional heads, to the governors of the federal subjects in Russia, saying that they can be in control of the response to sanctions. Now, that's not the Kremlin trying to help the situation, to say, look, the response to economic conditions has to vary by region. It's so that if things get even worse, the Kremlin can say, oh, well, we're not in control of the response to economic conditions. You need to blame your governor if things get even worse. And this fits a pattern of the Kremlin finding people to blame at every stage. We saw it, for example, at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. Moscow played a similar trick. They said, we're going to give more authorities to the governors. And that was a device to set them up so that they could blame them if things got worse. And so at the moment, it seems to be that the Kremlin are taking steps to stop most Russians turning their blame towards the Kremlin. And maybe if it's not going to be directed towards the West, turning it against regional leadership. But certainly going forward, it is going to be a worry. That's talking about the people. It's another topic entirely to talk about the elite and the extent to which they're going to be happy to remain on board. But I should say that the elite, members of the elite, groups within the elite, will, of course, be looking at how the population are acting, who they're blaming, and will take their cues regarding if they want to defect from the current system based on what the people are doing. But that seems quite far off at the moment. We just don't know. You know, it's the war has been going on now, at least since the February invasion, for 2 months. We shouldn't forget that this, of course, has a broader context, which goes back to 2014. So it was always tricky talking about, you know, the invasion. Well, it really began in 2014, but the February invasion is what lots of people are referring to now when they use the word invasion. It's only 2 months old. The sanctions, really, if they're going to bite, they're going to bite in the long term. And so there are still lots of question marks regarding how the people in Russia are going to react, who they're going to blame in the long term, but also how members, groups, factions within the elite, what they're going to do, whether they're going to remain loyal to the Putin leadership.
Regarding sanctions, I just want to add one comment. I've been thinking about it. What's the impact of on sanctions, not on the Russian economy, but on popular perceptions? So I think that the attitudes of many Russians towards the West will not change depending on the severity of sanctions. So in 2014 and 2015, those sanctions were pretty mild. Nonetheless, many Russians didn't like the West. Now, those sanctions are much more serious. They are much more meaningful. But those attitudes have not changed. And I think that at some point of time, so now people do not feel the living standards are going down. But Russia is a poor country, I want to say. So not many people are really well off. So they're used to living in poverty. That is an important thing to understand. So I think that if they start to feel that they are getting poor and poor, they will hold the Russian government responsible for that. I'm absolutely sure. Not the West. So, but it requires time for them to understand.
Of course, the difficult question, Zhanna, is when? What's your prediction for when they will start to blame?
So I think, there are a lot of unknown variables in this equation. I think that, so there are two things. The performance of the Russian army in Ukraine is important, and how they will present this performance, I don't know. I think that in 1 year, we will see a lot of changes, but it will not lead to regime change once again. But I think that the Russian government will face some problems, and people will realize their life conditions are worse than they used to be like 2 years ago something.
We started this conversation talking about crackdown in Russia and control of the population and fear and how that's deployed and how they are, you know, the muscle of the state is deployed to control. But there's also, as you were talking about support for this war, there that many Russians are choosing to support this war. Zhanna, have you found a gulf in an understanding that grows between you and other people? For example, people talk about finding that they no longer agree with their friends, that they don't understand, that there's a sense that they exist in different realities. Have you experienced this personally?
Well, because I'm the co-founder of the Boris Nemtsov Foundation, I've been observing the state of Russian society for many years, and I don't want to talk about my personal experience because I don't think that they are relevant. People around me share more or less the same views and the same values. But that is true that it's difficult now to conduct any reliable polls in Russia due to many reasons, one of which is, of course, a fear. So Russia has been said is a totalitarian state and people are afraid of speaking their minds. But I read a great piece written by Shura Butrin. He is, I think, one of the greatest journalists in Russia. His piece was published yesterday on Medusa, the biggest independent media outlet right now. So I hope they will translate it into English. Everybody should read it. If you can read it in Russia, please do. So what he did, he spoke to random people, not a classic poll, right? But he spoke to random people in Moscow, in the province of Kaluga and in the province of Kostroma. The findings of this report are very interesting. First of all, yes, that is true that if you ask a question, if you ask a random person in Russia, do you support the special military operation in Ukraine? You would hear more or less the same answer, yes, with varying degrees of certainty. But the problem is much deeper. First of all, the state of our society is disastrous. It's dreadful. People just do not think about anything. So Russian propaganda has done a lot of damage to our society. So many people cannot think, they cannot critically assess any political developments. They think that they can do nothing about anything in Russia. So they disengage from politics. And this kind of behavior has been just encouraged by Vladimir Putin for many, many years. So in their responses, they more or less repeat the narratives which are spread by Russian propaganda. like we didn't have any choice. We are fighting for peace, or we are fighting with Nazis, all this, I'm sorry, bullshit. And at the same time, many people understand in Russia that Russia is waging a war against Ukraine, but they don't want to face the reality. They do not want to hold responsibility for what's happening in our country. So it's a very childish behavior. One thing that concerns me, speaking about myself and others, I think it's a wrong approach to build a wall between lots of Russians and myself. So we are one nation. We don't have any other nation. I'm sorry. I am Russian. I was born and raised in Russia. Russian is my native language. I am trying hard to do something, not on a big scale, to improve the situation, being the leader of the Boris Nemtsov Foundation. So we do not have another population to deal with. We have to deal with this population. And I think that the most important goal for the future leadership of Russia is to change people's mindsets, to explain to them that they are not subjects of the Tsar, but they are citizens and they should be engaged and they should understand why it's important. And of course, they should face the reality. They should understand that what they are now doing in Ukraine is wrong, that violence is not a solution. It has never been a solution.
Ben, I mean, has anything jumped out to you that also helps to answer this question of to what extent Russians do support this war at the moment and why?
I mentioned previously that it's really tricky. It's clear that we can't trust the polls that the Kremlin is talking about. When we look at VTSIOM, which is a Kremlin-aligned polling agency, a state-owned polling agency, they're saying, look at this, extraordinary approval for what's happening in Ukraine, extraordinary approval for President Vladimir Putin's activities. But there are some things we can do as social scientists to try and get rid of what's called social desirability bias. So the pressure that some people may feel in a totalitarian political system to give the answer that they feel is expected of them, or that will get them into the least amount of trouble, rather than what they actually think. But I think Zhana mentioned something that goes much deeper, and which is why things are maybe more problematic than some people in the West might imagine. It could be that outside of Russia, people think, if only Russians on the evening news were able to see what we're seeing, then immediately they would be against the war and they would withdraw their support from Putin. I'm afraid that's nonsense. And it's nonsense for a variety of reasons, but one of them is because confronting people with this information, there are various reactions to that. It's not simply, oh, I was wrong, the Kremlin's wrong, Putin's wrong, let's get rid of him. It's how do I accommodate this information that doesn't fit with the narrative that is presented by state propaganda? How do I incorporate that in a way that doesn't destroy my life? And I think that is a very, very profound reason why it's going to be very tricky going forward to see how things are going to play out because of the ways in which Russians have been taught to think about their country, have been taught to think about how politics work, have been taught to think about what Putin means. He's not a democratically elected politician. He is the Tsar, as Zhana mentioned. And so when we think about what would have to change in quote-unquote everyday normal Russians, the sort of general citizen's mind, in order to challenge the current political system, there are lots and lots of moving parts, lots of things that have been stated year on year on year. And so we shouldn't imagine that there is going to be a coup or a revolution very soon, because lots of this has been established, has been set up for many, many years. And it's one of the reasons why some people who look at Russian politics might be surprised that Putin still is leader of the country after so many years, beyond all of the coercion, the repression, the murder of political rivals. There are lots of these other factors that feed into Russian political culture, the understanding, as I say, of the country's position in the world. And so it's not just as simple as showing them what actually happened, what is actually happening in Ukraine.
Zhana, when your father was looking at what was happening in Maidan, did that speak to him in Ukraine in 2014? I mean, the protests and the subsequent fall of the government in power.
Throughout his political career, he was not indifferent to what was happening in Ukraine. He basically took part in the first Maidan and he supported Viktor Yushchenko, and he was an aide on a pro bono basis to Viktor Yushchenko for a couple of months. So he visited Ukraine many, many times and he knew a lot of Ukrainian politicians, for example, the mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko. So they were basically not close friends, but they were friends. So my father was not indifferent. He always wanted Ukraine to succeed. And of course, he was shocked when he learned that Putin had annexed Crimea. And an interesting fact that he was in jail when Crimea was annexed. He was sentenced to a 10-day prison term. It was a minor offense. It was, of course, made up once again. And I came to visit him and I asked him, how are you? And he said, oh, you know, everybody has already forgotten about me because of the annexation of Crimea. So when he did that and when Putin waged the war in East Ukraine, he was preoccupied with those developments, with those decisions. But the reality was back then that this patriotic euphoria was so widespread in Russia that I can recall really well because I was in Russia back then. The vast majority of people, literally 90-something percent, supported Putin's decision to annexate Crimea, which I was like shocked. I didn't know what to do, why they were so short-sighted. So I could not explain those things. And my father lost a lot of his popularity, even among those people who basically shared his democratic values. People just liked this idea to get something for nothing. And I think that Putin and his inner circle miscalculated something when they decided to invade Ukraine. They underestimated the amount of resistance inside the country. And of course, they underestimated Vladimir Zelensky. They did not acknowledge him as a true, courageous leader. So they were wrong. They thought it would take 3 days to occupy the whole country. And I think that people during the first days of the invasion, people shared more or less the same. And now they just cannot embrace the idea that they're about to lose in this war. And I think, as a patriot of Russia, that Russia should be defeated in this war. And it will give good ground for reflections about our role in the world, our power in the world, and about many, many other things. But once again, the bottom line is that we should think about our society. And if somebody is willing to become a leader of Russia, I don't know who this person will be, he or she should think about changing this popular mindset of Russians. That's the main problem, because Putin understands his people perfectly well. But he doesn't want to change it. He's profiting from that. He's taking advantage of it.
Thank you, Zhanna and Ben. That was Zhanna Nemtsova and Ben Noble. Ben's book, Navalny, is now available from Hearst. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared. I've been Polina Ivanova. Thank you for listening.